He was hearing things, voices and noises that made no sense. The voices were not coming from the hall, but from within the room. Could it be the drugs? It could be a number of things, Patrick. The medicine, the fatigue, the trauma of what you've been through, the shock both physically and psychologically. They talked for an hour. Chapter 17. He didn't wash his hair for the third straight day. He wanted the oily look. He didn't shave either. For his outfit, he switched from the light cotton hospital gown he'd slept in back to the aqua surgeon scrubs, which were very wrinkled. Hayani promised to get him new ones, but for today he needed the wrinkles. He put a white sock on his right foot, but there was a nasty rope burn just above his left ankle, and he wanted people to see this. No sock there, just a matching black rubber shower sandal. He would be displayed today. The world was waiting. Sandy arrived at 10 with two pairs of cheap pharmacy sunglasses, per his client's instructions, and a black New Orleans Saints cap. "Thanks," Patrick said as he stood before the mirror in the bathroom and admired the sunglasses and prepared the cap. Dr. Hayani arrived minutes later, and Patrick introduced one to the other. Patrick was suddenly nervous and lightheaded. He sat on the edge of his bed, ran his fingers through his hair, and tried to breathe slowly. "I never thought this day would happen, you know," he mumbled to the floor. "Never." His doctor and his lawyer looked at each other with nothing to say. Hayani ordered a strong depressant, and Patrick gulped down both pills. "Maybe I'll sleep through it all," he said. "I'll do all the talking," Sandy said. "Just try and relax." "He's about to," Hayani said. A knock on the door, and Sheriff Sweeney entered with enough deputies to quell a riot. Stiff pleasantries were exchanged. Patrick put on his Saints cap and his new shades, large, dark ones, and held out his wrists to be handcuffed. "What are those?" Sandy demanded, pointing to a set of ankle irons a deputy was holding.
"Ankle irons," said Sweeney.
"I don't think so," Sandy said harshly. "The man has burns on one ankle."
"He certainly does,"
Dr. Hayani said boldly, anxious to enter the fray. "See?" he insisted, pointing to Patrick's left ankle. Sweeney pondered this for a moment, and his hesitation cost him. Sandy charged ahead.
"Come on, Sheriff, what are his chances of escape? He's injured, handcuffed, surrounded by all these people. What the hell's he going to do, break and run? You guys aren't that slow, are you?"
"I'll call the judge if necessary," Dr. Hayani said angrily.
"Well, he came here with ankle irons," the sheriff said.
"That was the FBI, Raymond," Patrick said. "And they were leg chains, not ankle irons, and they hurt like hell anyway." The ankle irons were put away, and Patrick was led into the hallway, where men in matching brown uniforms grew silent at the sight of him. They gathered around him, and the mob moved slowly toward the elevator. Sandy stayed to his left, gently holding him by the elbow. The elevator was too small for his entire entourage. The ones who didn't make it scurried down the staircase and met them in the lobby, where they reorganized and shuffled past the front reception and through the glass doors into the warm autumn air, where a regular parade of freshly waxed vehicles awaited them. They put him in a sparkling new black Suburban with Harrison County insignia plastered from bumper to bumper, and away they went, followed by a white Suburban carrying his armed protectors. It, in turn, was followed by three freshly cleaned patrol cars. In front, two more patrol cars, the newest additions to the fleet, led the invasion as it cleared military checkpoints and entered the civilian world. Through the cheap, thick sunglasses, Patrick saw everything outside. Streets he'd driven a million times. The houses looked familiar. They turned onto Highway 90, and there was the Gulf, its calm brown water seemingly unchanged since he left. There was the beach, a narrow strip of sand between the highway and the water, too far from the hotels and condos on the other side of the highway. The coast had prospered during his exile, thanks wholly to the surprising arrival of casino gambling. There had been rumors of its coming when he left town, and now he was riding past large Vegas-style casinos with glitz and neon. The parking lots were filling at 9:30 in the morning.
"How many casinos?"
he asked the sheriff, seated to his right.
13 at last count, with more on the way.
Hard to believe. The depressant was quite effective. His breathing became heavy and his body relaxed. He felt like nodding off for a moment. Then they turned onto Main Street, and he was anxious again. Just a couple of blocks now. A few more minutes and his past would come roaring back to greet him. By City Hall, to the left, quickly now for a glimpse of the Rue Marché, and in the middle of the old street lined with shops and stores, a fine, large, white building he once owned a piece of, as a partner in Bogan, Rapley, Vetrano, Haverack, and Lanigan, attorneys and counselors at law. It was still standing, but the partnership was crumbling within. Ahead was the Harrison County Courthouse, only a three-block walk from his old office. It was a plain, brick, two-story building with a small green lawn in the front next to Howard Street. The lawn was covered with people milling about. The streets were lined with cars. Pedestrians hurried along the sidewalks, all headed for the courthouse, it seemed. Cars ahead pulled over as Patrick and his caravan came through. The horde in front of the courthouse moved in a frantic wave around both sides, but was stopped by police barricades at the rear, where a section was cordoned off. Patrick had seen several notorious murderers rush to and from court through the back door, and so he knew exactly what was happening. The parade stopped, doors flew open, and a dozen deputies spilled forth. They crowded around the black Suburban. Its doors slid open slowly. Patrick eventually appeared, his aqua garb quite the contrast to the dark brown uniform squeezing around him. An impressive mob of reporters, photographers, and cameramen gathered breathlessly along the nearest barricade. Others behind them ran to catch up. Patrick was immediately aware of the spotlight, and he lowered his head and crouched among the deputies. They walked him quickly to the rear door, a barrage of idiotic questions flying over his head.
"Patrick, what's it like to be home? Where's the money, Patrick? Who burned up in the car, Patrick?"
Through the door and up the back stairway, a brief journey Patrick had sometimes taken when he was in a hurry to catch a judge for a quick signature, the smell was suddenly familiar. The concrete steps had not been painted in 4 years. Through a door, through a short hallway with a crowd of courthouse clerks gathered at one end, gawking at him. They put him in the jury room, which was next to the courtroom, and he took a seat in a padded chair by a coffee pot. Sandy hovered over him, anxious to make sure he was okay. Sheriff Sweeney dismissed the deputies, and they moved into the hall to wait for the next transfer.
"Coffee?" Sandy asked. "Please, black."
"You okay, Patrick?"
Sweeney asked.
"Yeah, sure, Raymond, thanks."
He sounded meek and scared. His hands and knees shook, and he couldn't make them stop. He ignored the coffee, and despite both hands cuffed together, adjusted his black sunglasses and pulled the bill of his cap further down. His shoulders sagged. There was a knock on the door, and a pretty girl named Belinda eased her head through just long enough to say,
"Judge Husky would like to meet with Patrick."
The voice was so familiar. Patrick raised his head, looked at the door, and said softly,
"Hello, Belinda." "Hello, Patrick. Welcome back."
He turned away. She was a secretary in the clerk's office, and all the lawyers flirted with her. A sweet girl. A sweet voice. Had it really been 4 years?
"Where?"
the sheriff asked.
"In here," she said, "in a few minutes."
"Do you want to meet with the judge, Patrick?" Sandy asked. It was not mandatory. Under normal circumstances, it would be downright unusual.
"Sure."
Patrick was desperate to see Carl Husky. She left, and the door clicked behind her.
"I'll step outside," Sweeney said. "I need a cigarette."
Finally, Patrick was alone with his lawyer. He suddenly perked up. "Couple of things. Any word from Leah Parrish?"
"No," Sandy said. "She'll get in touch soon, so be ready. I've written her a long letter, and I'd like for you to get it to her."
"Okay." "Second, There's an anti-bugging device called a DX-130 made by Lo Kim, a Korean electronics outfit. Costs about $600, about the size of a portable dictaphone. Get one and bring it with you whenever we meet. We'll disinfect the room and the phones before each little conference. Also, hire a reputable surveillance firm in New Orleans to check your office twice a week. It's very expensive, but I'll pay for it. Any questions? No? Another knock, and Patrick slouched again. Judge Carl Husky entered the room alone, robeless, in shirt and tie, with reading glasses perched halfway down his nose. His gray hair and wrinkled eyes made him appear much older and wiser than 48, which was exactly what he wanted. Patrick was looking up and already smiling when Husky offered his hand. "Good to see you, Patrick," he said warmly as they shook hands, the cuffs rattling. Husky wanted to reach down and hug him, but with judicial restraint, he limited the contact to a soft handshake. "How are you, Carl?" Patrick said, keeping his seat.
"I'm fine. And what about you?"
"I've had better days, but it is good to see you, even under these circumstances."
"Thanks. I can't imagine..."
"Guess I look different, don't I?"
"You certainly do. I'm not sure I would recognize you on the street."
Patrick only smiled. Like a few others who still professed some level of friendship for Patrick, Husky felt betrayed. But even more so, he felt great relief in knowing that his pal was not dead. He was deeply worried about the capital murder charge. The divorce and the civil suits could be dealt with, but not murder. Because of their friendship, Husky would not preside over the trial. He planned to handle the preliminary matters, then step aside long before the important rulings were due. There had already been a story about their history.
"I assume you will enter a plea of not guilty," he said.
"Yes, that's correct."
"Then it will be a routine first appearance. I'll deny bail, since it's capital murder."
"I understand, Carl."
"Whole thing won't take 10 minutes.
"I've been here before. The chair will be different, that's all." In 12 years on the bench, Judge Husky had often been astonished at the amount of sympathy he could muster for average people who'd committed heinous crimes. He saw the human side of their suffering. He saw guilt eat them alive. He'd sent to prison hundreds of people who, if given the chance, would have left his courtroom and never sinned again. He wanted to help, to reach out, to forgive. But this was Patrick. His honor was almost moved to tears at the moment. His old friend, bound and dressed in a clown suit, eyes covered, face altered, nervous and twitchy and scared beyond words. He'd like to take him home, feed him some good food, let him rest, and help him pull his life together. He kneeled next to him and said,
"Patrick, I can't hear this case, for obvious reasons. Right now, I'll handle the preliminary stuff to make sure you're protected. I'm still your friend. Don't hesitate to call."
He patted him very gently on the knee, hoping he didn't touch a raw spot.
"Thanks, Carl," Patrick said, biting his lip.
Carl wanted eye contact, but it was impossible with the sunglasses. He stood and headed for the door.
"Everything's routine today, Counselor," he said to Sandy.
"Are there a lot of people out there?" Patrick asked.
"Yes, Patrick, friends and enemies alike. They're all out there."
He left the room. The coast had a long and rich history of sensational murders and notorious criminals, so crowded courtrooms were not uncommon. No one could remember, though, such a packed house for a simple first appearance. The press had arrived early and taken the good seats. Since Mississippi was one of the few remaining states with the good sense to ban cameras from the courtroom, the reporters would be forced to sit and watch and listen, then put in their own words what they saw. They would be forced to be real reporters, a task for which most of them were ill-equipped. Every big trial attracted the regulars, clerks and secretaries from courthouse offices, bored paralegals, retired cops, local lawyers who hung around most of the day sipping free coffee in the clerks' offices, gossiping, examining real estate deeds, waiting for a judge to sign an order, doing anything to stay away from the office. And Patrick attracted all these and more. In particular, there were many lawyers present just to get a glimpse of Patrick. The papers had been filled with stories about him for 4 days now, but no one had seen a current photo. Rumors were rampant about his appearance. The torture story had elevated curiosity even more. Charles Bogan and Doug Vetrano sat together in the middle of the pack, as close to the front as they could get. The damned reporters beat them to the courthouse. They wanted to be on the front row, near the table where the defendant always sat. They wanted to see him, to make eye contact, to whisper threats and vulgarities, if at all possible, to spit as much bile as they could in this civilized setting. But they were 5 rows back, waiting patiently for a moment they thought would never come. The third partner, Jimmy Haverack, stood along the back wall and chatted quietly with a deputy. He ignored the stares and glances from people he knew, many of whom were other lawyers who secretly had been delighted when the money vanished and the firm lost its fortune. It would have been, after all, the largest single fee earned by any firm in the history of the state. Jealousy was the natural tendency. He hated them, as he hated virtually everyone else in the courtroom. A bunch of vultures waiting for a carcass. Haverack, the son of a shrimper, was still stout and crude and not beyond a barroom brawl. 5 minutes alone with Patrick in a locked room and he'd have the money. The fourth partner, Ethan Rapley, was at home in the attic as usual, working on a brief in support of some insipid motion. He would read about it tomorrow. A handful of the lawyers were old buddies who came to cheer Patrick on. Escape was a common, usually unspoken, dream of many small-town lawyers trapped in an overcrowded, boring profession where expectations were too high. At least Patrick had the guts to chase the dream. There was an explanation for the dead body. They were sure of that. Arriving late and pushed into a corner was Lance. He had loitered around back with the reporters, taking the measure of the security. It was quite impressive, at least for now. But could the cops keep it up every day, during a long trial? That was the question. Many acquaintances were present, people Patrick had known only in passing, but who now suddenly claimed to have been his dearest friends. Some, in fact, had never met Patrick, but that didn't stop their idle chatter about Patrick this and Patrick that. Likewise, Trudy suddenly had new friends who had stopped by to scowl at the man who had broken her heart and abandoned precious little Ashley Nicole. They read paperbacks and scanned newspapers and tried to look bored as if they didn't really want to be there. There was movement among the deputy clerks and bailiffs near the bench, and the courtroom instantly grew quiet. The newspapers were lowered in unison. The door next to the jury box opened, and brown uniforms poured into the courtroom. Sheriff Sweeney entered, holding Patrick by the elbow, then 2 more deputies, then Sandy brought up the rear. There he was, necks strained and stretched, and heads bobbed and weaved. The courtroom artists went to work. Patrick walked slowly across the courtroom to the defense table, his head down, though from behind the sunglasses he was searching the spectators. He caught a glimpse of Haverack on the rear wall, his scowling face speaking volumes. And just before he sat, he saw Father Philip, his priest, looking much older but just as amiable. He sat low, his shoulders sagging, chin down. No pride here. He did not look around because he could feel the stares from every direction. Sandy put his arm on his shoulder and whispered something meaningless. The door opened again, and T.L. Parrish, the district attorney, entered, alone, and walked to his table next to Patrick's. Parrish was a bookish sort, with a small ego, contained ego. No higher office was calling him. His trial work was methodical, absent of any trace of flamboyance, and lethal. Parrish currently carried the second highest conviction rate in the state. He sat next to the sheriff, who had moved from Patrick's table to where he belonged. Behind him were agents Joshua Cutter, Brent Myers, and 2 other FBI types Parrish couldn't even name. The stage was set for a spectacular trial, yet it was at least 6 months away. A bailiff called them to order, made them stand while Judge Husky entered and assumed his perch on the bench. "Please sit," were his first words, and everyone obeyed. The matter of State versus Patrick S. Lanigan, case number 961140. Is the defendant present?
Yes, Your Honor,
Sandy said, half standing. Would you please rise, Mr. Lanigan? Husky asked. Patrick, still handcuffed, slowly pushed his chair back and got to his feet. He was semi-bent at the waist, with his chin and shoulders down, and it was no act. The depressant had deadened most parts of his body, including his brain. He stiffened a bit.
Mr. Lanigan, I'm holding a copy of an indictment returned against you by the grand jury of Harrison County, in which it is alleged you murdered one John Doe, a human being, and for this you have been charged with capital murder. Have you read this indictment?
Yes, sir, he announced, chin up, voice as strong as he could make it.
Have you discussed it with your attorney?
Yes, sir.
How do you wish to plead?
Not guilty.
Your plea of not guilty is accepted. You may sit down.
Husky shuffled some papers, then continued.
The court, on its own motion, hereby imposes a gag order on the defendant, the attorneys, the police and investigating authorities, any and all witnesses and all court personnel, effective now and lasting until the trial is over. I have copies of this order for everyone to read. Any violation of it will result in contempt of court, and I will deal harshly with any violators. Not one word to any reporter or journalist without my approval. Any questions from the attorneys?
His tone left little doubt that the judge not only meant what he said, but relished the thought of going after violators. The lawyers said nothing.
Good. I have prepared a schedule for discovery, motions, pretrial, and trial. It's available in the clerk's office. Anything else?
Parrish stood and said, Just one small matter, Your Honor. We would like to get the defendant in our detention facility as soon as possible. As you know, he's now at the base in a hospital, and, well,
I just talked to his doctor, Mr. Parrish. He's undergoing medical treatment. I assure you that as soon as he is released by his doctor, then we'll transfer him to the Harrison County Jail.
Thank you, Judge.
If nothing else, then we stand adjourned.
He was rushed from the courtroom, down the back stairs, into the black Suburban as the cameras clicked and rolled. Patrick nodded, then napped as he was returned to the hospital. Chapter 18. The only crimes Stefano possibly committed were the kidnapping and assault of Patrick, and convictions were unlikely. It happened in South America, far from U.S. jurisdiction. The actual assault was conducted by others, including some Brazilians. Stefano's lawyer was confident that they would prevail if pressed to trial. But there were clients involved, and a reputation to protect. The lawyer knew all too well the FBI's ability to harass without actually prosecuting. It was his advice that Stefano cut the deal, agree to spill his guts in return for the government's promise to grant immunity to him and his clients. Since no other crimes were involved, what was the harm? The lawyer insisted on sitting with Stefano while his statement was taken. The sessions would last for many hours over several days, but the lawyer wanted to be there. Janes wanted it done in the Hoover Building by his men. Coffee and pastries were served. Two video cameras were aimed at the end of the table where Stefano sat, calmly in his shirt sleeves, his lawyer by his side.
"Would you state your name?" asked Underhill, the first of the interrogators, each of whom had memorized the Lanigan file.
"Jonathan Edmund Stefano, Jack."
"And your company is?"
"Edmund Associates."
"And what does your company do?"
"Lots of things. Security consulting, surveillance, personnel research, locating of missing persons."
"Who owns the company?"
"I do, all of it."
"How many employees do you have?"
"It varies. As of now, 11 full-time, 30 or so part-time or freelancers."
"Were you hired to find Patrick Lanigan?"
"Yes."
"When?"
"March 28, 1992.
Stefano had files packed with notes, but he didn't need them.
"Who hired you?"
"Benny Aricia, the man whose money was stolen."
"How much did you charge him?"
"The initial retainer was $200,000.
"How much has he paid you to date?"
$1.9 million.
"What did you do after you were hired by Benny Aricia?"
"Several things. I immediately flew to Nassau in the Bahamas to meet with the bank where the theft occurred." It was a branch of the United Bank of Wales. My client, Mr. Aricia, and his former law firm had established a new account there to receive the money. And as we now know, someone else was waiting on the money, too.
Is Mr. Aricia a U.S. citizen?
Yes.
Why did he establish an account offshore?
It was $90 million. 60 for him, 30 for the lawyers, and nobody wanted the money to appear in a bank in Biloxi. Mr. Aricia lived there at the time, and it was agreed by all that it would be a bad idea for anyone locally to see the money.
Was Mr. Aricia trying to avoid the IRS?
I don't know. You'll have to ask him. That was none of my business.
Who did you talk to at the United Bank of Wales?
The lawyer snorted his disapproval, but said nothing. Graham Dunlap, a Brit, a vice president of some sort with the bank.
What did he tell you?
Same thing he told the FBI, that the money was gone.
Where did it come from?
Here, in Washington. The wire began at 9:30 on the morning of March 26, 1992, originating from D.C. National Bank. It was a priority wire, meaning it would take less than an hour for it to land in Nassau. At 15 minutes after 10, the wire hit the United Bank, where it sat for 9 minutes before it was wired to a bank in Malta. From there, it was wired to Panama.
How did the money get wired out of the account?
The lawyer was irritated by this.
This is a waste of time, he interrupted. You guys have had this information for 4 years now. You've spent more time with the bankers than my client has. This is a waste of time, he interrupted. You guys have had this information for 4 years now. You've spent more time with the bankers than my client has.
Underhill was unfazed.
We have a right to ask these questions. We are simply verifying what we know. How did the money get wired out of the account, Mr. Stefano?
Unknown to my client and his lawyers, someone, Mr. Lanigan, we presume, had accessed the new offshore account and had prepared the Malta wiring instructions in anticipation of the money coming in. He prepared bogus wiring instructions from my client's lawyers, his old firm, and rerouted the money 9 minutes after it landed. They, of course, thought he was dead and had no reason to suspect anyone was after the money. The settlement which produced the $90 million in the first place was extremely secret, and no one, with the exception of my client, his lawyers, and a handful of people at the Justice Department, knew exactly when or where the money was wired.
As I understand it, someone was actually at the bank when the money arrived.
Yes. We're almost certain it was Patrick Lanigan. On the morning the money was wired, he presented himself to Graham Dunlap as Doug Vetrano, one of the partners in the law firm. He had perfect identification, passport, driver's license, etc., plus he was well-dressed and knew all about the money which was about to be wired from Washington. He had a notarized partnership resolution authorizing him to accept the money on behalf of the firm, then wire it to the bank in Malta.
"I know damned well you have copies of the resolution and the wire transfer authorizations," the lawyer said.
"We do," Underhill said, flipping through his notes and paying little attention to the lawyer. The FBI had tracked the money to Malta and from there to Panama, where all trails vanished. There was a blurred still shot taken from the bank security camera of the man who presented himself as Doug Vetrano. The FBI and the partners were certain it was Patrick, though he was wonderfully disguised. He was much thinner. His hair was short and very dark. He had grown a dark mustache and worn stylish horn-rimmed glasses. He had flown in, he explained to Graham Dunlap, to personally monitor the receiving and transferring of the money, because the firm and the client were quite nervous about the transaction. That was certainly not unusual in Dunlap's view, and he was happy to oblige. He was sacked a week later and returned to London.
"So we went to Biloxi and spent a month there looking for clues," Stefano continued.
"And you found the law offices to be wired?"
"We did. For obvious reasons, we were immediately suspicious of Mr. Lanigan, and our task was twofold. First, to find him and the money, and second, to determine how we had pulled the heist. The remaining partners granted us access to their offices for one weekend, and our technical people picked the place apart. It was, as you say, infested. We found bugs in every phone, in every office, under every desk, in the hallways, even in the men's restroom on the first floor. There was one exception. The office of Charles Bogan was completely clean. He was fastidious about locking it. The bugs were high in quality, 22 in all. Their signals were gathered by a hub we found hidden in a storage file box in the attic, in a spot no one had touched in years.
Underhill listened, but didn't hear. This was, after all, being recorded on video, and his superiors could study it later. He was quite familiar with these preliminaries. He pulled out a technical summary which analyzed in four dense paragraphs the bugging scheme installed by Patrick. The microphones were state-of-the-art, tiny, powerful, costly, and manufactured by a reputable firm in Malaysia. Illegal to buy or possess in the United States, they could be purchased with relative ease in any European city. Patrick and Trudy had spent New Year's in Rome, 5 weeks before his death. The hub found in the attic storage box had impressed even the FBI experts. It was less than 3 months old when Stefano found it, and the FBI reluctantly admitted it was at least a year ahead of their latest wizardry. Made in Hungary, it could receive signals from all 22 bugs hidden in the offices below, keep them separate, then transmit them, one at a time or all at once, to a satellite dish nearby. "Did you determine where the signals were being relayed to?" Underhill asked. It was a fair question, because the FBI certainly didn't know. "No. It has a range of 3 miles in all directions, so it would be impossible to tell." "Any ideas?" "Yes. A very good one. I doubt Lanigan was foolish enough to set up a receiving dish anywhere within 3 miles of downtown Biloxi. He would have to rent space, hide the dish, spend lots of time there monitoring hours of conversations. He has proven to be quite methodical. I've always suspected he used a boat. It would be much simpler and safer. The office is only 600 yards from the beach. There are a lot of boats in the Gulf. A man could drop anchor 2 miles out and never speak to another soul."
"Did he own a boat?"
"We couldn't find one."
"Any evidence he used a boat?"
"Maybe." Stefano paused here because he was now entering territory unknown to the FBI.
The pause quickly irritated Underhill. "This is not a cross-examination, Mr. Stefano."
"I know. We talked to every charter outfit along the coast, from Destin to New Orleans, and found only one possible suspect. A small company in Orange Beach, Alabama, leased a 32-foot sailboat to a man on February 11, 1992, the day Lanigan was buried. Their rate was $1,000 a month. This guy offered twice that if the transaction could be done in cash with nothing in writing. They figured he was a doper and said no way. The guy then offered a $5,000 deposit plus $2,000 a month for 2 months. Business was slow, the boat was insured against theft, they took a chance."
Underhill listened without blinking. He took no notes.
"Did you show them a picture?"
"Yeah. Said it could have been Patrick. But the beard was gone, the hair was dark, baseball cap, eyeglasses, overweight. This was before he discovered Ultra Slim Fast. Anyway, the guy couldn't make a positive ID."
"What name did he use?"
"Randy Austin. Had a Georgia driver's license. And he refused to provide more identification. He was offering cash, remember, $5,000. The guy would have sold it to him for $20,000.
"What happened to the boat?"
"They got it back eventually. The guy said he got real suspicious because Randy didn't seem to know much about sailboats. He asked questions, fished around. Randy said he was in the process of drifting south after a bad marriage in Atlanta. Tired of the rat race, lots of money, that routine. Used to sail a lot and now wanted to float down to the Keys and practice his skills along the way. Said he'd always keep the shore in sight. It was a nice story, and the guy felt somewhat better, but he was still suspicious. Next day, Randy appeared from nowhere. No car, no cab, as if he had walked or hitchhiked somehow to the dock. And after a lot of preliminaries, he left with the boat. It had a big diesel engine of some sort, and it would cruise at 8 knots regardless of the wind. He disappeared, going east, and the owner had nothing else to do, so he eased down the coast, stopped at a couple of favorite bars along the way, and managed to keep an eye on Randy, who was a quarter of a mile out and doing a decent job of handling the boat. He docked it at a marina at Perdido Bay and left in a rented Taurus with Alabama registration. This went on for a couple of days. Our guy kept an eye on the boat. Randy played with it, a mile out at first, then he ventured farther. On the third or fourth day, Randy took it west toward Mobile and Biloxi and was gone for 3 days. He came back, then left, going west again, never east or south in the direction of the Keys. The guy stopped worrying about his boat because Randy stayed close to home. He would leave for a week at a time, but he always came back.
And you think it was Patrick?
I do. I'm convinced of it. Makes perfect sense to me. He was isolated on the boat. He could go for days without speaking to another person. He could gather his intelligence from 100 different spots along the Biloxi Gulfport shore. Plus, the boat was a perfect place to starve himself.
What happened to it?
Randy left it at the dock and simply vanished without a word. The owner got his boat back plus the $5,000.
Did you examine the boat?
With a microscope. Nothing. The guy said the boat had never been so clean.
When did he disappear?
The guy wasn't certain because he stopped checking on the boat every day. He found it at the dock on March 30, 4 days after the money was stolen. We talked to a kid who was on duty at the dock, and to the best of his recollection, Randy docked on either March 24 or March 25 and was never seen again. So the dates match up perfect.
What happened to the rental car?
We tracked it down later. It was rented from the Avis desk at the Mobile Regional Airport on Monday morning, February 10, about 10 hours after the fire was put out. Rented by a man with no beard, clean-shaven, short dark hair, horn-rimmed glasses, wearing a coat and tie, and claiming he just stepped off a commuter flight from Atlanta. We showed pictures to the clerk on duty, and she made a very tentative ID of Patrick Lanigan. Evidently, he used the same Georgia driver's license. He used a phony Visa card, one with the name of Randy Austin and a number he stole from a legitimate account in Decatur, Georgia. Said he was a self-employed real estate developer in town to look at land for a casino, so he had no company name to put on the form. He wanted the car for a week. Avis never saw him again. Didn't see the car for 14 months.
Why wouldn't he return the car? Underhill asked, musing.
Simple. When he rented it, his death had just happened and had not been reported. But the next day, his face was on the front page of both the Biloxi and Mobile papers. He probably figured it was too risky to take the car back. They found it later in Montgomery, wrecked and stolen.
Where did Patrick go?
My guess is that he left the Orange Beach area on March 24 or 25. He assumed the identity of Doug Vetrano, his former partner. We learned that on the 25th he flew from Montgomery to Atlanta, then first class to Miami, then first class to Nassau. All tickets were in the name of Doug Vetrano, and he used a passport when he left Miami and again when he entered the Bahamas. The flight arrived in Nassau at 8:30 on the morning of the 26th, and he was at the bank when it opened at 9. He presented the passport and other papers to Graham Dunlap. He diverted the money, said goodbye, caught a flight to New York, and landed at LaGuardia at 2:30 p.m. At that point, he ditched the Vetrano papers and found some others. We lost him. When the bidding got to $50,000, Trudy said yes. The show was Inside Journal, a slash-and-burn tabloid with solid ratings and apparently lots of cash. They set up lights and covered windows and ran wires throughout the den. The journalist was Nancy DeAngelo, flown straight in from L.A. with her own band of hairdressers and makeup artists. Not to be outdone, Trudy spent 2 hours in front of the mirror and looked absolutely glorious when she appeared. Nancy said she looked too good. She was supposed to be wounded, hurt, broke, besieged, handcuffed by the court, angry at what her husband had done to her and her daughter. She retreated in tears, and Lance had to console her for half an hour. She looked almost as good when she returned in jeans and a cotton pullover. Ashley Nicole was used as a prop. She sat close to her mother on the sofa.
"Look real sad now," Nancy told her as the technicians checked the lights. "We need tears from you," she said to Trudy. "Genuine tears."
They chatted for an hour about all the horrible things Patrick was doing to them. Trudy cried when she recalled the funeral. They had a picture of the shoe found at the site. She suffered through the months and years afterward. No, she had not remarried. No, she had not heard from her husband since he had returned. Wasn't sure if she wanted to. No, he had made no effort to see his daughter. And she broke down again. She hated the thought of divorce, but what was she to do? And the lawsuit, how horrible! This nasty insurance company hounding her like she was a deadbeat. Patrick was such a horrible person. If they found the money, did she expect to get any of it? Of course not. She was shocked by the suggestion. It was edited to 20 minutes, and Patrick watched it in his dark hospital room. It made him smile. Chapter 19. Sandy's secretary was clipping his photo and the story of yesterday's brief court appearance from a New Orleans paper when the call came. She immediately found him, extracted him from a crowded deposition, and put him on the phone. Leah Parrish was back.
She said hello and immediately asked if he'd had his office checked for bugs. Sandy said yes, just yesterday. She was in a hotel suite on Canal, a few blocks over, and she suggested the meeting take place there. A suggestion from her carried more weight than a directive from a federal judge. Whatever she wanted, he was excited just to hear her voice. She was in no hurry, so Sandy strolled leisurely down Poydras, then to Magazine, then to Canal. He refused to watch his back. Patrick's paranoia was understandable. Poor guy had lived on the run until the ghosts finally caught him. But no one could ever convince Sandy that the same people would shadow him. He was a lawyer in a high-profile case. The bad guys would be crazy to tap his phones and stalk him. One bungled move, and serious damage could be done to the case against Patrick. But he had contacted a local security firm and made an appointment to have his offices swept for bugs. This was his client's wish, not his. Leia greeted him with a firm handshake and a quick smile, but he could tell instantly that she had many things on her mind. She was barefoot, in jeans and a white cotton T-shirt, very casual, the way most Brazilians probably are, he thought. He'd never been down there. The closet door was open. There weren't many clothes hanging. She was moving around quickly, living out of a suitcase, probably on the run, just as Patrick had been until last week. She poured coffee for both of them and asked him to sit at the table. "How is he?" she asked. "He's healing. The doctor says he'll be fine." "How bad was it?" she asked quietly. He loved her accent, slight as it was. "Pretty rough." He reached into his briefcase, removed a folder, and slid it to her. "Here." She frowned at the sight of the first photo, then mumbled something in Portuguese. Her eyes watered as she looked at the second one. "Poor Patrick," she said to herself. "Poor baby." She took her time with the photos, gently wiping tears with the back of her hand until Sandy found the presence of mind to get her a tissue. She wasn't ashamed to cry over the pictures, and when she was finished with them, she placed them in a neat stack and put them back in the folder. "I'm sorry," Sandy said. He could think of nothing else to offer. "Here's a letter from Patrick," he finally said. She finished her crying and poured more coffee. "Are any of the injuries permanent?" she asked. "The doctor thinks probably not. There will be scarring, but with time everything should heal."
"Mentally, how is he?"
"He's okay. He's sleeping even less. He has nightmares constantly, both day and night. But with medication, he's getting better. I honestly can't imagine what he's going through." He took a sip of coffee and said, "I guess he's lucky to be alive."
"He always said they wouldn't kill him."
There was so much to ask her. The lawyer in Sandy almost screamed out an endless barrage. Did Patrick know they were close behind him? Did he know the chase was about to end? Where was she when they were closing in? Did she live with him? How did they hide the money? Where is the money now? Is it safe? Please tell me something. I'm the lawyer. I can be trusted.
"Let's talk about his divorce," she said, abruptly changing the subject. She could sense his curiosity. She stood and walked to a drawer where she removed a thick file and placed it before him. "Did you see Trudy on TV last night?" she asked.
"Yes. Pathetic, wasn't it?"
"She's very pretty," Leia said.
"Yes, she is. I'm afraid Patrick made the mistake of marrying her for her looks."
"He wouldn't be the first."
"No, he wouldn't."
"Patrick despises her. She is a bad person, and she was unfaithful to him throughout their marriage."
"Unfaithful?"
"Yes. It's all in the file there. The last year they were together, Patrick hired an investigator to watch her. Her lover was a man named Lance Maxa, and they were seeing each other all the time. There are even some photographs of Lance coming and going from Patrick's house when he was away. There are pictures of Lance and Trudy sunbathing by Patrick's pool. Naked, of course."
Sandy took the file and flipped quickly until he found the photographs. Naked as newborns. He smiled wickedly. "This will add something to the divorce."
"Patrick wants the divorce, you understand. He will not contest it. But she needs to be silenced. She's having a nice time saying all those bad things about Patrick."
"This should shut her up. What about the child?"
Leia took her seat and looked him squarely in the eyes. Patrick loves Ashley Nicole, but there is one problem. He is not the father. He shrugged, as if he heard this every day. Who is?
Patrick doesn't know. Probably Lance. It seems as if Lance and Trudy have been together for some time. It goes back to high school, even.
How does he know he's not the father?
When the child was 14 months old, Patrick obtained a small blood sample by pricking her finger. He sent it, along with a sample of his, to a lab where DNA tests were run. His suspicions were correct. He is definitely not the father of the child. The report is in the file.
Sandy had to walk around a bit to sort things out. He stood in the window and watched the traffic on Canal. Another clue in the Patrick puzzle had just fallen into place. The question of the moment was this. How long had Patrick planned his departure from his old life? Bad wife, bastard child, horrible accident, no corpse, elaborate theft, take the money and run. The planning was astonishing. Everything had worked perfectly, until now, of course.
Then why fight the divorce? He asked, still looking below. If he doesn't want the child, why bring up the trash?
Sandy knew the answer, but he wanted her to explain it. In doing so, she would give the first glimpse of the rest of the master plan.
You bring up the trash only to her lawyer, she said. You show him the file, all of it. At that point, they'll be anxious to settle.
Settle as in money?
Correct.
What type of settlement?
She gets nothing.
What is there to get?
Depends. It could be a small fortune or a large one.
Sandy turned and glared at her.
I cannot negotiate a property settlement if I don't know how much my client has. At some point you guys have to clue me in.
Be patient, she said, thoroughly unruffled. With time you'll know more.
Does Patrick really think he can buy his way out of this?
He'll certainly try.
It won't work.
Do you have a better idea?
No.
I didn't think so. It's our only chance.
Sandy relaxed and leaned against the wall. It would be helpful if you guys would tell me more.
We will, I promise. But first we'll take care of the divorce. Trudy has to relinquish all claims to his assets.
That should be easy. And fun.
Get it done and we'll chat again next week.
It was suddenly time for Sandy to leave. She was on her feet, gathering papers. He took his files and placed them in his briefcase.
How long will you be here? He asked.
Not long, she said, and handed him an envelope. That's a letter for Patrick. Tell him I'm fine, I'm moving around, and so far I haven't seen anyone behind me.
Sandy took the envelope and tried to make eye contact. She was nervous and anxious for him to leave. He wanted to help her, or at least to offer, but he knew whatever he said at this point would be dismissed. She forced a smile and said,
You have a job to do, so do it.
Patrick and I will worry about the rest. While Stefano told his story in Washington, Benny Aricia and Guy set up camp in Biloxi. They leased a 3-bedroom condo on the back bay and installed phones and a fax. The theory was that the girl would have to surface in Biloxi. Patrick was confined, and for the foreseeable future, his life was fairly predictable. He wasn't going anywhere. She would have to come to him. And they had to catch her when she did. Aricia had budgeted $100,000 for this last little campaign, and that would be the end of it, he swore to himself. Down almost $2 million, he simply had to stop burning money while he had some left. Northern Case Mutual and Monarch Sierra, the other two members of his shaky partnership, had thrown in the towel. Stefano would keep the FBI happy with his tall tales, while hopefully Guy and the rest of the organization could find the girl. It was a long shot. Osmar and his boys were still loitering in the streets of Rio, watching the same places each day. If she came back, they would see her. Osmar used a lot of men, but they worked cheap down there. Returning to the coast brought back bitter feelings in Benny Aricia. He had moved there in 1985 as an executive of Platt and Rockland Industries, a mammoth conglomerate which had sent him around the world for 20 years as a troubleshooter. One of the company's more profitable divisions was New Coastal Shipyards in Pascagoula, between Biloxi and Mobile.
In 1985, New Coastal received a $12 billion Navy contract to build four Expedition-class nuclear submarines, and someone upstairs decided Benny needed a permanent home. Raised in New Jersey, educated in Boston, and the husband at the time of a repressed socialite, he was miserable living on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. He considered it a serious diversion from the corporate hierarchy he longed for. His wife left him after 2 years in Biloxi. Platt & Rockland was a public company with $21 billion in stockholders' equity, 80,000 employees and 36 divisions in 103 countries. It retailed office supplies, cut timber, made thousands of consumer products, sold insurance, drilled for natural gas, shipped containerized cargo, mined copper, and among many other ventures, built nuclear submarines. It was a sprawling mass of decentralized companies, and as a rule, the left hand seldom knew what the right one was doing. It amassed huge profits in spite of itself. Benny dreamed of streamlining the company, of selling off the junk and investing in the prosperous divisions. He was unabashedly ambitious, and through the ranks of upper managers, it was well known that he wanted the top job. To him, life in Biloxi was a cruel joke, a pit stop from the fast lane orchestrated by his enemies within the company. He detested contracting with the government, detested the red tape and bureaucrats and arrogance from the Pentagon. He hated the snail's pace with which the submarines were built. In 1988, he asked to be transferred and was denied. A year later, the rumors of serious cost overruns on the Expedition project surfaced. Construction came to a halt as government auditors and Pentagon brass descended on New Coastal shipyards. Benny was on the hot seat, and the end was near. As a defense contractor, Platt & Rockland had a rich history of cost overruns, overbilling, and false claims. It was a way of doing business, and when discovered, the company typically fired everybody near the controversy and negotiated with the Pentagon for a small repayment. Benny went to a local attorney, Charles Bogan, the senior partner in a small firm, which included a young partner named Patrick Lanigan. Bogan's cousin was a U.S. senator from Mississippi. The senator was a rabid hawk who chaired the Subcommittee on Military Appropriations and was dearly loved by the armed services. Lawyer Bogan's mentor was now a federal judge, and thus the small firm was as politically well-connected as any in Mississippi. Benny knew this and carefully selected Bogan. The False Claims Act, also known as the Whistleblower Law, was designed by Congress to encourage those with knowledge of overbilling in government contracts to come forward. Benny studied the act thoroughly, and even had an in-house lawyer dissect it for him before he went to Bogan. He claimed he could prove a scheme by Platt & Rockland to overbill the government some $600 million on the Expedition project. He could feel the axe dropping, and he refused to be the fall guy. By squealing, he would lose any chance of ever finding comparable work. Platt & Rockland would flood the industry with rumors of his own wrongdoing. He would be blacklisted. It would be the end of Benny's corporate life. He understood very well how the game was played. Under the Act, the whistleblower may receive 15% of the amount repaid to the government by the offending corporation. Benny had the documentation to prove Platt & Rockland's scheme. He needed Bogan's expertise and clout to collect the 15%. Bogan hired private engineers and consultants to review and make sense of the thousands of documents Aricio was feeding him from inside New Coastal shipyards. The scheme was tied together nicely, and it turned out not to be so intricate after all. The company was doing what it had always done, charging multiple prices for the same materials and fabricating paperwork. The practice was so ingrained at Platt & Rockland that only two upper managers at the shipyards knew it existed. Benny claimed to have stumbled upon it by accident. A clear and convincing case was assembled by the lawyers, and they filed suit in federal court in September of 1990. The lawsuit alleged $600 million in fraudulent claims submitted by Platt & Rockland. Benny resigned the day the suit was filed. The lawsuit was meticulously prepared and researched, and Bogan pressed hard. So did his cousin. The senator had been placed in the loop long before the actual filing, and monitored it with great interest once it arrived in Washington. Bogan did not come cheap, nor did the senator. The firm's fee would be the standard one-third. One-third of 15% of $600 million. The senator's cut was never ascertained. Bogan leaked enough dirt to the local press to keep the pressure on in Mississippi, and the senator did the same in Washington. Platt and Rockland found itself besieged by hideous publicity. It was pinned to the ropes, its money cut off, its stockholders angry. A dozen managers at New Coastal Shipyards were fired. More terminations were promised. As usual, Platt and Rockland negotiated hard with justice, but this time made no progress. After a year, it agreed to repay the $600 million and to sin no more. Because two of the subs were half-built, the Pentagon agreed not to yank the contract. Thus, Platt and Rockland could finish what was planned as a $12 billion project, but was now well on its way to $20 billion. Benny got set to receive his fortune. Bogan and the other partners in the firm got set to spend theirs. Then Patrick disappeared, followed by their money. Chapter 20. Pepper Scarborough's shotgun was a Remington 12-gauge pump he purchased from a pawn shop in Lucedale when he was 16, too young to buy from a licensed dealer. He paid $200 for it, and according to his mother, Nell Dean, it was his most beloved possession. Sheriff Sweeney and Sheriff Tatum of Greene County found the shotgun, along with a well-worn sleeping bag and a small tent, a week after Patrick's death as they were making a routine inventory of his cabin. Trudy had given permission for the search, which in itself was a major problem since she had no ownership interest in the cabin. Any effort to use the shotgun, sleeping bag, and tent as evidence in Patrick's murder trial would be met with fierce resistance since they were found without a search warrant. A valid argument could be made that the sheriffs weren't searching for evidence since there wasn't at that time a crime. They were simply gathering up Patrick's personal effects to hand over to his family. Trudy didn't want the sleeping bag and the tent. She was adamant in her belief that they didn't belong to Patrick. She had never seen them before. They were cheap, unlike items Patrick would buy. And besides, he didn't camp. He had the cabin to sleep in. Sweeney put labels on them and stored them in his evidence room, for lack of a better place. He planned to wait a year or two, then sell them at one of his annual sheriff's sales. 6 weeks later, Nell Dean Crouch burst into tears when confronted with Pepper's camping gear. The shotgun was handled differently. It was found under a bed, along with the tent and the sleeping bag, in the room Patrick slept in. Someone had hurriedly slid the items under the bed, in Sweeney's opinion. His curiosity was immediately aroused because of the presence of the shotgun. An avid hunter himself, he knew that no hunter with a brain would leave a shotgun or hunting rifle in a remote cabin for thieves to take at their convenience. Nothing of value was ever left in a hunting cabin in these parts. He had carefully examined it on the spot and noticed the serial number had been filed off. The gun had been stolen at some point since its manufacture. He discussed it with Sheriff Tatum, and they made the decision to at least have it checked for fingerprints. Nothing would come of it, they were sure, but both were experienced and patient cops. Later, after repeated promises of immunity, the pawnbroker in Lucedale admitted he had sold the gun to Pepper. Sweeney and Ted Grimshaw, the chief investigator for Harrison County, politely knocked on Patrick's hospital door and entered only when invited in. Sweeney had called ahead to alert Patrick of their visit and to inform him of its purpose. Just routine procedures. Patrick had yet to be properly booked. They photographed his face while he was sitting in a chair, wearing a T-shirt and gym shorts, his hair unruly and his expression sour. He held the booking numbers they had brought along. They took his fingerprints, with Grimshaw doing the work as Sweeney handled the conversation. Patrick insisted on standing over the small table while Grimshaw took the prints. Sweeney asked a couple of questions about Pepper Scarborough, but Patrick quickly reminded him he had a lawyer, and his lawyer would be present during any interrogation. Furthermore, he had nothing to say about anything, with or without a lawyer. They thanked him and left. Cutter and an FBI fingerprint expert from Jackson were waiting in the Lanigan room at the jail. At the time it was found, Pepper's 12-gauge yielded more than a dozen full, usable prints. They had been lifted by Grimshaw after dusting, filed away in a vault, and now were spread on the table. The shotgun was on a shelf, next to the tent and the sleeping bag and the jogging shoe and the photographs, and the few other sparse items of evidence to be used against Patrick. They drank coffee from plastic cups and talked about fishing while the print expert compared the old with the new through a magnifying glass. It didn't take long. "Several of these are perfect matches," he said, still working. The gun stock was covered with Lanigan's prints. Certainly good news, they thought. Now what? Patrick insisted on a different room for all future meetings with his attorney, and Dr. Hayani was quick to make the necessary arrangements. He also requested a wheelchair to transport him to the room on the first floor. A nurse pushed him past the two deputies sitting benignly in the hall outside his door, past Special Agent Brent Myers, and onto the elevator for the brief ride to the first floor. One of the deputies trailed along. The room was one used by doctors for staff meetings. The hospital was small, and the room appeared to be used sparingly. Sandy had ordered the anti-bugging scanner, Patrick had mentioned, but it wouldn't be in for a few days. "Please rush it," Patrick said. "Come on, Patrick. Surely you don't think they would bug this room. No one knew we would use it until an hour ago. We can't be too careful." Patrick stood from the wheelchair and walked around the long conference table, walked without any limp whatsoever, Sandy noted. "Look, Patrick, I think you should try and relax a little. I know you've been on the run for a long time. You've lived in fear, always looking over your shoulder. I know all that. But those days are over. They caught you. Relax. They're still out there, okay? They have me, but not the money, and the money is much more important. Don't forget that, Sandy. They won't rest until they have the money. So, who might be bugging us here? Good guys or bad? Cops or crooks? The people who lost the money have spent a bloody fortune trying to find it." "How do you know?" Patrick merely shrugged as if it were time to play games again. "Who are they?" Sandy asked. And there was a long pause, one similar to those used by Leia when she wanted to change the subject. "Sit down," Patrick said. They sat on opposite sides of the table. Sandy removed the thick file Leia had given him 4 hours earlier, the Dirt on Trudy file. Patrick recognized it immediately. "When did you see her?" he asked anxiously. "This morning. She's fine, sends her love, says nobody's stalking her yet, and asked me to deliver this." He slid the envelope across the table, where Patrick